And welcome back to New Books in Literary Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. My name is Miranda Corcoran, and I will be your host today. In this episode, we're going to be speaking with Christopher G. White, whose exciting new book, Other Worlds, Spirituality and the Search for Invisible Dimensions, was published this year by Harvard University Press. So welcome to the show, Christopher, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Miranda, for having me. It's a pleasure.
So it's great to have you here. Your book is, I think, a really exciting project. It really undermines that sort of divisive view that people have of the relationship between science and spirituality. It really reconfigures that whole discourse. So it's a really fascinating work. So I just wanted to jump in by, I suppose, asking you about the project as a whole. And you start off by noting how, in the course of researching an earlier book, you were struck by the ways in which many contemporary theologians, religious leaders, and the faithful in general often borrow ideas and metaphors from the natural sciences in order to articulate their own thoughts on miracles or the afterlife or the survival of the soul. But one interesting point, I suppose, is that this isn't just a modern or a New Age phenomenon. Science and the supernatural have been intersecting in various fascinating ways throughout human history, from mesmerism during the Enlightenment right up to Victorian psychical researchers. So there's always been this very interesting relationship between the scientific and the spiritual. Yeah. Could you tell us a bit more about why the scientific and the spiritual are perhaps not as opposed as we might initially assume?
Yeah, sure. I think you're right. I think that what we call science and what we call religion have been intertwined for a long time, even going back long before the Enlightenment. I think we think today that science and religion are in conflict because of the work of really 19th century scientists who were professionalizing, who were building their disciplines. And some of them, actually, I look at in my first book. You mentioned my first book, which is Unsettled Minds. It's sort of a look at a cultural history of sciences of mind and brain. And in social sciences in general, but in psychological sciences in particular, you have early psychologists really building their discipline by excluding speculative, theological, and even philosophical questions. So I think that those people are some of the main people who generate this narrative that science and religion are in conflict and have always been in conflict. And in fact, some of those same people wrote narratives in the late 19th century about the quote conflict between science and religion. And they wrote these grand narratives about about the history of science and religion, and they were all about conflict between the church, between the Catholic Church, and the rise of modern science, and really there were narratives of scientific triumph over religion as well, right? And I think we still have that narrative in pop culture today. I mean, we certainly have that narrative. We have many scientists and many spokespeople for science who get up there and say, what we really need to do is we need to get rid of religion because it's opposed to kind of modern thought. In my first book and in this book, In Other Worlds, I do try to, like many other people, right? I do try to say, wait a minute, that's not actually how things have worked. That narrative of science against religion is a narrative certainly promoted by many science spokespeople and also promoted on the other side by Christian fundamentalists. But most people exist in a middle space with their different ways of thinking and imagining the world. And I think that it's in that middle space that there's a lot more to talk about. There's a lot of interesting stories there. And my book, Other Worlds, exists in that sort of middle space where I try to talk about scientific thinking and religious thinking, all as related and all as imaginative. And the imagination is an important word that bridges, I think, science and religion in this book. It's a book about the idea that the universe has invisible spaces or layers or dimensions to it. And that's something that scientists and mathematicians imagine in certain ways. And it's something that religious people imagine too. So the concept that there are these invisible spaces or dimension is a concept that becomes important in 19th century mathematics and in physics. And then some of those mathematicians themselves, who have what we say spiritual inclinations or religious interests or religious questions, they start to speculate about the real existence of these higher dimensional spaces. And then other people do as well, right? There's many people. My book is about all the different kinds of people who say, wow, this is a really interesting idea. Could there be borderland spaces that exist beyond the senses? And does this new mathematics point to them? If that's true, what does it say about where departed spirits go, right? Or what does that say about what I think about heaven? Or what does that say about what I think about my Christianity or my Judaism? All of those questions are a part of the book.
That's really great. So your book, I suppose, focuses in particular on one very specific idea, and that's an idea derived from physics primarily, the idea that the universe has these higher invisible dimensions that you were speaking about. So where does this idea come from, and how does it lend itself to religious or spiritual discourse?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, in the 19th century, it emerges as an important idea that mathematicians use and physicists use in order to make the mathematics of the universe more simple and elegant. So mathematicians start to assume that, that there's a fourth spatial dimension because it seems to make their way of thinking about the universe and all of its forces, electromagnetism and gravity. It seems to maybe bring them together and the mathematics of it looks more elegant. So these were ideas that were used in the 19th century. They still are used today, right? This is still, I guess I would say, the basic strategy that string theorists and cosmologists use today. These are really mathematically oriented physicists use today in order to try to do something that still hasn't actually been done, right? Which is come up with one set of simple, elegant equations for the universe. We still don't have one set, right? I mentioned in my book, we have two sets. We have a set of, we have a way of thinking and a set of equations that governs the world of the very small, the quantum world. And then we have a separate set of equations for the world of the very large, on more cosmological scales and for gravity. We don't actually have a theory or a mathematics that brings those two theories together. We know that both of them work. We know that quantum mechanics works. It's been shown to be true, and it's been shown to work many times over. We also know that Einstein's theory of gravity is true. The problem is that those two theories don't fit together. And one way that people are trying to fit them together is by positing the existence of other higher invisible dimensions, other spaces beyond our three spatial dimensions, and even other time dimensions, which is even more confusing than trying to talk about what it might mean to talk about what is an invisible space, right? And how could there be something above our three familiar spaces, right? So we have our world apparently has three spaces. We have length, we have width, and we have height. Well, could there be another space? Could there be a space beyond that? Could there be a fourth space, a fifth space, a sixth space, and so on? So these ideas, getting back to your question, these ideas become important in the 19th century. Mathematicians and physicists use them. Incidentally, they become important for Einstein too, and we can talk about Einstein a little bit later if you want. So they become intriguing to people. Some mathematicians and physicists even say, wow, like I said, wow, this could be, maybe this suggests the existence of real other spaces. And in fact, one astrophysicist, German astrophysicist with the last name of Zollner, Carl Zollner, working at Leipzig, became very interested in this. And he wrote this book in 1880 called Transcendental Physics. Okay. So this is not just a physics of the natural world, but it's a physics that points beyond. And he was a true believer in this idea that, the mathematics of higher dimensions points to a real a real higher dimensional space. And he actually brings in this American spiritualist medium named Henry Slade, and he does a series of seances. It's a quite remarkable story, actually, that I unfortunately don't talk about too much in the book. It's a fascinating story, but he brings in a number of prominent scientists, including this guy, Wilhelm Wundt, who's one of the founders of modern experimental psychology. And they all sit with them around this table and with Henry Slade, and they do seances. And Zollner's idea is that, you know, if Slade or other people who have a kind of spiritual or metaphysical proficiency, if they could somehow work through and within higher dimensions, they could do miraculous things. Right. And Slade actually has some success convincing Zollner that he's doing it, that he's actually moving things through a higher space. Other folks sitting around the table were less persuaded. I mentioned Wundt, but there were others who wrote about this later. They were less persuaded. And there actually develops a whole, in the early 1880s, a whole controversy about what Zollner's doing, and most scientists are sort of disgusted by, you know, what they believe is his sort of perversion of science. You know, science should not be about invisible things. Science should not be about unseen things. Science should not be about non-empirical things, like spirits or ghosts. And here was Zollner. Trying to talk about a science of the invisible. So, and this fits back to what I said earlier about the ways scientists were professionalizing their disciplines, you know, and disciplining their disciplines, right, in these decades, right, in the late 19th century, really, you know, quite deliberately excluding things that were unempirical. You know, you definitely see this in the history of sciences of mind and brain, but you see it in the history of many sciences. So what Zollner was doing was really transgressive. And it wasn't just Zollner who sort of saw spiritual possibilities in a mathematics or a geometry of higher dimensions. It was others as well. But, you know, what you see in my book is you see scientists, if they're interested in this kind of stuff, sort of secretly talking about it. You know, they're not talking about it at scientific conferences. They're sometimes not talking about it to their scientific colleagues, but they might be writing narratives about it. They might be writing letters about their sort of spiritual or religious questions and how the idea of higher dimensions could help them answer those questions. You know, some of them, like the main character in chapter 2, Charles Howard Hinton, some of them don't quite fit in academia. Some of them don't quite fit in academic mathematics or academic physics, because Hinton becomes a kind of an enthusiast for seeing or somehow perceiving, or maybe we should say imagining, a higher dimension. And he develops a whole pedagogy of seeing higher dimensions, and he ends up getting pushed out of academia. So he starts as an academic in the UK and then comes to Princeton as an assistant professor and actually does a lot of other things that academics hoping for tenure shouldn't do, like coaching the baseball team at Princeton and inventing an automatic pitching gun that the Princeton baseball team used. Actually, I think it was the first you know, automated pitching gun in the world. His initial gun was actually a cannon, which you can imagine, you know, standing up at the plate waiting for the ball to come at you. It was a cannon that actually had a charge and blew a baseball at the batter. So I think it was a little bit scary, but he did a lot of things he shouldn't have been doing if he's trying to get tenure. And so he had to move on to another place. And then he finally ended up just being a writer. And like I said, sort of not fitting as an academic. Again, because the way he wanted to talk about higher dimensions was sort of as, I don't know, what would we say, sort of imaginative, and I think even spiritual. I think in my book I try to be careful about how I talk about his spiritual yearning, because he talks a lot about higher dimensions in a materialistic way and in a secular way, and yet he also says things like, I feel emotionally released, or I feel imaginatively released by pondering higher dimensions. And to me, that to me, that says something different, you know, as someone who's trying to interpret what he's doing. To me, Higher Dimensions was a kind of a spiritual pursuit for him that really did kind of unlock a whole new way of being in the world and being comfortable in the world. And I make that point in that chapter too, that chapter about Hinton, chapter two.
I think this whole idea of higher dimensions is a really fascinating idea. But throughout the book, you don't just talk about the history of the idea. You also look at how various writers and artists and creative individuals generally engaged with this idea of higher dimensions. And your book begins with a close reading of Edwin Abbott's hugely influential 1884 novel, Flatland, a book which actually attempts to apply mathematical and geometrical ideas to the supernatural. So how does Abbott achieve this? And why is his novel so important to our understanding of the relationship between the spiritual and the scientific in the 19th century?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you're right. Edwin Abbott's classic book is really central to my book. It's the first chapter that I start out with, and he's wrestling with all these issues we've already talked about. You know, he's very well read. He's reading in math. He's reading in, I guess, what we could call popular science of his day. He knows about higher dimensions. He's a teacher and a principal, headmaster at a private at the City of London School. So he's really well read. He's also an Anglican priest, so he also has a kind of a spiritual or religious interest and set of questions. And I think he's like a lot of people in my book. He's a religious or spiritual person living in a time of science. And I think that he, like many others, are caught in this moment when you have the emergence of agnosticism. And you have the emergence of agnosticism even as a word, right? Even as a category. And you have the powerful, you have a powerful set of people who are talking about Darwinian evolution and scientific naturalism and so on. And so Abbott is wrestling with all of those things. And he then encounters this idea that there might be a fourth dimension, a fourth spatial dimension. And he uses this, I think, in imaginative ways to think about the possibilities that there might be other sorts of invisible spaces to reality, even sort of heavenly sorts of spaces, spiritual kinds of spaces. So yeah, he writes this book, Flatland, which many of us know. I actually read it for the first time years ago as a senior in high school in calculus, right? I think many math students still read this wonderful book. It's really kind of an enchanting story. About higher dimensions. It takes place actually in a lower dimensional world. And maybe for anyone who's listening who is unfamiliar with the story, I can just say a word about the story. But it takes place in a two-dimensional flat world, right? The story is called Flatland. So in this two-dimensional flat world, it's a world with only length and width, but no height or depth, all right? So all of the characters in this story slide around on the surface of this flat world, like their squares and their circles and their triangles, and they would be sliding around just like on the surface of a table, right? They just exist in this flat world, in this flat two-dimensional world. At a certain point in the narrative, there's a lot to the story, actually, Victorian social critique and so on. There's gender. There's all kinds of interesting stuff in there, actually. But at a critical moment in the story, the main character, who is a square, encounters a being from a higher dimension. This is a three-dimensional sphere, right, or globe. And this three-dimensional sphere comes down and inserts itself into the flat plane of Flatland. All right, and so when a three-dimensional sphere comes down and intersects with a flat plane, the square is sitting there or sliding there in his flat world, and he sees something appear, okay, on the horizon, right? What does he see? Well, he doesn't see a sphere because he only is two-dimensional. He sees a cross-section of a sphere, right? He sees a line appear. Actually, the sphere, as it comes into his flat world, first appears as a point on his flat horizon, and then it appears as a line that sort of expands in length, right, as the sphere comes down into the plane of Flatland. and the square doesn't know what this is. He's puzzled. He's confused. The sphere actually makes things worse by starting to talk to him, right? A voice, a disembodied voice coming from nowhere or from a somewhere that the square doesn't understand. So to make a long story short, the sphere says, you know what? You live in a flat world. You have left and right and forward and back in your world. Those are your two directions. But there's actually another direction that you can't perceive. This is what the sphere says. The square can't believe it. Thinks it's got to be a lie. And the sphere resorts to an extreme possibility, and he peels the square off of his flat world. And he pulls the square off of his flat two-dimensional world and up into three-dimensional space. And at this point in the novel, the square is amazed, right? Because he can look down. Now he's in a three-dimensional space that has length and width and height. And he can look down on the flat plane of Flatland, his world, right? Or what he used to think was his world. And he can see the whole thing laid out in front of him. And so the story continues. The square is amazed by this. He returns to all of the other Flatlanders. He can't believe it. He tells them about it. It turns out that this kind of knowledge is forbidden by the priestly circles, by the priestly class in his society. And he's shunned as well because Victorian Britain is conventional, and you know they don't want to think about things that are not a part of the already existing social order. So he's sort of shunned, and he ends up dying in a jail at the end of the narrative. All right. But Abbott is using the story in very particular ways. And when you read the story, you can it's not hard to discover what Abbott's purpose is, because he says in the narrative, right? He says, I, the square, wrote this narrative for Spacelanders who live in three-dimensional space in order that they might think, well, you know what? Maybe there's a higher space above their reality, right? So he says that I've created this book in order for people who live in space, three-dimensional space, so they might be able to think about or imagine or just entertain the possibility that a higher space might exist above them. What would it be like? In other words, right, we might play this out for a second. What would it be like if a higher dimensional visitor came and visited us? Right, and appeared suddenly in some strange shape, like it did for the square, appeared suddenly with some sort of strange, unrecognizable shape, appeared in the center of a room and started talking to us and so on. So Abbott wanted to use this idea of higher spatial dimensions and a visitor from a higher space to say that, maybe it's possible that there are other sorts of higher spaces above us in our familiar world of three spatial dimensions. And he doesn't actually say, in the book, he does say those types of things that I just said. He doesn't go a step further in the book, okay? And he doesn't say, well, that must be where God lives, all right? Or that must be where Jesus is from. Or he doesn't say things in the book like, well, this is an explanation for Christ's incarnation, all right? But I actually think, and I make the argument in chapter one of the book, that these are the kinds of puzzles that Abbott is trying to solve, right? And he's actually trying to solve them by using mathematical concepts and scientific concepts. So in other words, why is the incarnation so puzzling, right? This is, after all, getting something that is a higher dimensional reality into our lower dimensional earth, our lower dimensional world. What happens? Well, we only see fragments. We only see glimpses. We only see cross sections of this something that exists. So if you like, you could think of, again, going back to the incarnation with a capital I, if you like, you could think of Jesus as a lower dimensional cross section of God, of a higher dimensional God. And Abbott did think like this. And you see this in his other writings. He was a very prolific guy, actually, and wrote a lot of theology. I make the point in the book that he really spent his life devoted to writing these really erudite, volumes of theology. Unfortunately, they were all cast aside, and the book that he's remembered by today was this really wonderful, imaginative, short novella, Flatland. But again, Abbott really is, I think, working on theological questions in Flatland, even if he's not completely upfront about that.
Absolutely. I think Flatland is actually a really engaging way of imagining what could be a very difficult and a very abstract concept. So I just wanted to move on to look a bit at your second chapter where you discuss C. Howard Hinton and his use of mathematics to probe theological questions. And I think that while many people may not have heard of Hinton himself, I'm sure most of them are familiar with his concept of the Tesseract, because it's an idea that would go on to be massively influential in 20th century science fiction, everywhere from literature to comic books to movies. So where does this idea of the Tesseract come from, and how does it go on to influence both science fiction and mystical literatures?
Yeah, right, exactly. No, I'm glad you started with Abbott and Hinton, because they're at the start of the book. And as you say correctly, both of their work is so important. You know, Hinton's Tesseract pops up in so many different places that I talk about in the book, going all the way to later in the 20th and early 21st century with people who talk about near-death experiences and films that we know like Interstellar and authors that we know like Madeleine L'Engle. And of course, Abbott's book Flatland gets riffed on and taken up in so many places. And that's all a part of the narrative that I tell there. But yeah, you're right. Hinton is a more obscure figure than Abbott, and a more puzzling figure in many ways. Maybe a more eccentric figure. I talk quite a bit in the book about his reformer father and his own sort of reforming impulses and his own sort of unique way of thinking about liberal reforms and thinking about gender and thinking about marriage. And Hinton was, as you know, convicted of bigamy. So he takes one wife and then takes another. And so he has a whole plan that goes beyond just helping people imagine higher dimensions. But he does, as I say in the book, he does get really excited about higher dimensions. And mathematics and philosophy. He's trained in math, actually, as a way of sort of reimagining the world and his place in it. And he does, as you say, he does coin the word tesseract, right, for what we could also call a fourth dimensional cube, or it's also called a hypercube today. All right. So if you Google Tesseract or Hypercube, you'll come up with all kinds of links. You'll come up with all kinds of Wikipedia pages and you'll come up with computer models, actually rotating computer models of what a Tesseract might look like. Right. If we were to be able to perceive one. So Hinton does coin the term Tesseract. You're right. Then Tesseract shows up in all kinds of 20th and 21st century science fiction. Hinton wasn't the first person to think about fourth dimensional objects, though. I should underscore that point. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, mathematicians and physicists were talking about a fourth dimension and talking about about higher dimensional objects, right? Could we have a fourth dimensional cube? Could we have a fourth dimensional triangle or a fifth dimensional and so on? And actually, if you do Google Tesseract or Hypercube, you can go onto various pages and you can look at, you know, the ways that geometers today and mathematicians today think about what would a fourth dimensional cube look like or a fifth dimensional cube. We know what the properties of these objects might be, right? So for instance, we know what the properties, just to scale it back for a second, we know what the properties of a flat two-dimensional square are, okay? We know that a square, like on a piece of paper, has, for instance, it's bounded by four lines, okay? So, and then moving up a dimension to a three-dimensional object, we know a cube is bounded by six flat planes, all right? By analogy, we know that a hypercube or a tesseract, and this is where it gets hard to imagine, but a hypercube or a tesseract is bounded by eight cubes. Now, like I said, that's where it gets a little hard to imagine. So this is an object that is bounded by eight cubes, eight three-dimensional cubes. Kind of hard to imagine what that might be. But we know what the properties, like I said, we know what the properties of these higher dimensional objects would be. And mathematicians and geometers like Tom Banshoff at Brown, for instance, who's really well known for thinking about higher dimensional geometries today. He just retired, actually. I think he retired in 2014. but he's still around. He's a real lover of Edwin Abbott and Flatland and has done a lot of research himself on Flatland. We know what these higher dimensional objects would be. So Hinton wasn't the first to think about what we would call hypercube or a fourth dimensional cube or a tesseract. But he did, as you say, popularize it. And he does traffic in all kinds of cubes, right? We know, or you know from reading my chapter on Hinton, that he's really interested in modeling, right? He ends up kind of going around door to door to friends and family and to anyone who would listen about his system of stacking and memorizing cubes and different cube formations. And he ends up with a Rubik's cube that is 3 cubes by 3 cubes on the bottom by 3 more cubes. So it's a Rubik's cube that's 3 by 3 by 3, which is actually just like a Rubik's cube, which is 27 cubes. And he stacks these cubes up. He memorizes how they're configured. Then he rotates the whole cube structure. And then he memorizes where everything is again, right? And as you know from reading the book, this is quite a, what would we say, quite an imaginative thought experiment. I mean, quite a feat, really, of memory to do the kinds of things he was doing, which is memorizing the locations of those 27 cubes. In some cases, the colors, he would use different colors, the colors of those 27 cubes in the Rubik's Cube. In other cases, he would come up with unique names, right? For all of the edges, all the points, all the faces of all the 27 cubes, right? When you add up all those variables, it's really a remarkable accomplishment to memorize those things. What was he doing? You know, what in the world was he doing with this? You know, and many people thought he was nuts. I mean, many people thought what he was doing was kind of nuts. In fact, you had scientists quite explicitly saying, don't do this because it will lead to insanity. It will lead to a kind of mental imbalance. Hinton denied that was the case, but as I mentioned in the book, there were cases, you know, of this. There were cases in newspapers in the UK, right, of students and other people going mad from trying to imagine a fourth spatial dimension or imagine a tesseract. So Hinton has this whole system, right, that he popularizes and promotes in various ways. I mentioned a relationship he has with the American philosopher and psychologist William James. They have a wonderful relationship and correspondence that I talk about in the book. Both of them were sympathetic, right, in a way, to this idea that there could be something more to reality. You know, Hinton thought the more was spatial. And I think James thought the more was within consciousness, and that's, but I think they both wanted to work on that issue, that problem. In fact, James tried to help him out. James offered him a loan. He loaned him money. He offered the Lowell lectures. Harvard has a lecture series called the Lowell lectures. He offered it to Hinton, and Hinton eventually ended up declining it, which is unfortunate because he had some interesting things to say, and he would have had a bigger platform to say them. He declined them because I think he felt insecure. He felt a bit insecure coming to Harvard. He talked about feeling insecure and not sure what I'm going to say or how I would convince people. He always kind of felt bad about not convincing enough mathematicians and scientists about the reality of fourth dimensional space. This is one thing that actually sets Hinton apart and makes him, I guess, kind of a misfit, is he did believe, unlike the many other mathematicians and geometers of his time and even physicists who thought it was interesting to think about and even model higher spaces, Hinton actually believed in the existence of real higher dimensional spaces. So that makes him a bit different, right? And as I said earlier, he also kind of embraces the imaginative power of that space. And unlike most people, he says he glimpses it, which is kind of a big claim. I mentioned earlier that seeing a tesseract, you know, is not something that most people would say that they could see. You know, an object, a fourth dimensional cube bounded by 8 cubes. It's not something that we can really perceive. Hinton believed that with his, you know, pedagogy of re-educating the senses, one could actually achieve a transcendent form of vision. One could actually achieve a higher dimensional form of sight. That was a big claim. And, you know, you asked earlier about who takes up these ideas and who borrows these ideas, which is, after all, a big part of my new book. Well, people, you know, many people get interested in Hinton. Some of them are secular and some of them are just interested in a thought experiment and in the imagination. But many of the other folks are religious people or spiritual people. And I talk in there about spiritualists. I talk about theosophists. I talk about Christians and Jews in the book. So many other people were interested in this idea because they thought, well, you know, maybe this is a way of cultivating a form of transcendent vision. You know, is it possible that if I use Hinton's methods, I could somehow develop a form of transcendent sight? You know, I could see into a beyond, right? I could see a non-empirical reality somehow. You know, Hinton's like canny publisher, when he published one of his books, appended the subtitle, you know, Ghosts Explained. Yeah, you know, that's the subtitle to one of Hinton's books. So they're capitalizing, right, in the 1890s, 1900, 1910, they're capitalizing on this sort of widespread culture of ghost seeking and culture of ghosts in novels and in pop culture, right? Here's a way that you could actually cultivate a type of ghostly seeing, right, a higher dimensional seeing. Maybe if you use Hinton's methods, you could do this. So, you know, a lot of the later chapters of my book are all about religious people who borrow this idea because of its liberatory or spiritual or imaginative possibilities, right? And C.S. Lewis is in there and Madeleine L'Engle's in there and many lesser known religious figures, many theosophists are in there, you know, and other folks in pop culture who are making television shows like The Twilight Zone, The Outer Limits, who are making films, and so on. So many people are borrowing and many people are interested in these kinds of things.
So what was the reaction amongst, say, more mainstream scientists and mathematicians to this use of mathematics and geometry as a means of justifying beliefs in higher dimensions? I believe there was some backlash and some criticism of thinkers like Hinton.
Absolutely. Yeah, right. Absolutely. I think there was a lot of protecting of the boundaries of what legitimate mathematics and science is, especially science and physics, right? So, and you have some of those boundary disputes that go on today as well, right? In modern physics, you have mathematical physicists, including string theorists, right, who talk about, frankly, unempirical things, right? They use mathematical formulas to model the universe, and their formulas, in many cases, string theory is one case, cannot be tested at this point. They are called by some other physicists too speculative, right? Or not science. Okay, that kind of work, that's not science. Why is it not science? It's not science because it's not testable. Right, you can't test these kinds of things, and it was the same way as you say, during Hinton's time. Right, there were arguments among mathematicians and among scientists about, you know, do these types of speculations about higher dimensions have a place? Do they have a place within science, or are they something else? Right, and Hinton, who embraces higher dimensional speculation as a kind of as a new way of imagining reality, and as I said, as a kind of a spiritual practice, he's definitely rejected by mainstream mathematicians, right? And that's towards the end of the Hinton chapter that I have in there, and it's in other chapters as well. So there's a back and forth, right? There's a set of arguments in the book about what counts as legitimate science, or what, on the other hand, is quote speculative, right? Or unempirical. Or cannot be tested. So part of the book too tries to deal with how do people define and argue about the borders of science and what counts. And like I said, those conversations we still have those today, right? You have mathematical physics on the one hand and other kinds of physics on the other hand, and some people saying, you know, look, string theory is not a testable thing. And of course, the string theory say, wait a minute, you know, science does. include things like mathematics, right? And mathematics can point us eventually to things that can be testable and things that can be true, right? And we could see this in the history of physics. We could see this with Einstein, for instance, right? With Einstein's general theory of relativity. So this is a mathematical structure, a set of non-empirical models that Einstein creates, right? Where he tries to reimagine and understand in a more satisfactory way what gravity is. It was a wholly unempirical, practice, really. It was a set of thought experiments and a set of mathematical equations. It was later in 1919 proven to be correct. All right. But string theorists today, like mathematical physicists in the past, could say, wait a minute, you can't rule out this kind of work just because it's not testable right now, right? Because mathematics, even though it is unempirical in the ways that other people talk about empiricism, shouldn't be ruled out, because maybe mathematics can lead us to true statements and even provable statements about the world. So there was a lot of pushback. You're right. There were some of that I capture in the book. A lot of scientists say this is not something we should be talking about as science. This is metaphysics. If someone dared to sort of bring these kinds of speculations into professional journals, they would usually be shouted down or excluded in various ways. I would say mainstream science and was sort of allergic to these types of ways of thinking, for sure.
So I just want to jump ahead a little bit now to talk about Claude Bragdon, who is a really interesting figure. And you talk quite a bit about his writings, and you suggest that his writings on the relationship between mathematics and spirituality may have been read by a lot of modernist artists, people like Marcel Duchamp, Max Weber, Salvador Dali, and so on. And do you think the sort of mathematical or scientific conceptualization of the supernatural had an influence on the development of 20th century art?
Oh, yeah, sure. There's no question. And in fact, my friend Linda Henderson at UT Austin wrote a big book that's come out in a new edition on higher dimensions. The book is called The Fourth Dimension and Non-Euclidean Geometry in Modern Art. I think that's the title. Linda Henderson. So she's pretty extensively, traced this kind of history that you're pointing to between higher dimensional mathematics, non-Euclidean geometry, and the way it plays out in modern art in 20th century and all the way through to the 21st century. Like I said, she has a new edition of that book that came out recently. I think it was in 2013 with MIT Press, where she updates it. So yeah, there's no question that these ideas, these mathematical ideas and these ideas from physics influence a number of people. I talk about them in the book, from the American cubist Max Weber, Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali. I mean, many people could be in there. I think that modern artists in the, beginning in the early 20th century were interested in science. They were interested in all kinds of sciences, not just the scientific idea that there were higher spatial dimensions. So they were interested in new ideas. And I point to the cubists in particular in my book as a group of artists who were interested in the mathematics of higher dimensions. There are conversations within the cubist community, within the art community, about what it means to appropriate this scientific idea, or what it means to appropriate responsibly these kinds of ideas. So there were arguments among artists about, hey, wait a minute, you're misappropriating these mathematical ideas and using them in your art. And then there was pushback. So there were conversations even within the art world about what does it mean to be a non-scientist and use scientific ideas. Some of that's in the story that I tell as well. There's two cubists that I could contrast, Pablo Picasso and Max Weber. Max Weber is the subject of chapter 5 in my book. And they're different because, Picasso's interested in scientific ideas. He's interested in ideas about higher dimensions, but he's not interested in using them, what would we say, in a spiritual way. Whereas Max Weber, who I write about more extensively in the book, is, he sort of is interested in this idea as a way of what would we say, opening up a window into another reality, or, you know, opening up art as a way of seeing beyond our world of familiar dimensions, or beyond our familiar world of three spatial dimensions, into something else, right? And that something else to Weber was always a spiritual something else. I mean, he, throughout his life, he always believed that great art, you know, quote unquote, great art, always had to be spiritual art or religious art. And he thought he was creating a new form of religious art, right? Very different from older forms of religious art. Very abstract, but he would use these ideas. He would use ideas from Hinton. He would use ideas from other hyperspace philosophers or other people writing about higher dimensions. And some of these artists would use ideas from Bragdon as well. Again, not all cubists were interested in seeing the absolute or seeing the spirit behind matter. But many of them were, especially those influenced by Theosophy, as many of them were as well, like Kandinsky and others, right? These are modern artists who believe that modern art is actually the new form of spiritual seeing, right? And modern artists are our new prophets. And Max Weber embraced that identity as well. Right, he embraced that. He embraced the idea of higher dimensions. He was one of the first artists to write about, this point I make in the chapter, but one of the first artists to write about this idea that there could be a fourth spatial dimension or other higher spatial dimensions, right? And think about how we might use that to rework what art is. And then I talk about a number of his paintings in the book, in the ways I think he mobilizes that concept in order to get people imagining or thinking about higher realities above our everyday realities. And Claude Bragdon's trying to do that too, right? I write about Claude Bragdon in the book. He's another artist, architect, right, who's interested in, he has a slightly different project. I mean, he's interested in creating a more public landscape and urban landscape of higher dimensions, right? Rather than painting, which is what Max Weber was doing. You know, is there a way in which we could redesign urban spaces? Is there a way in which we could redesign Central Park in New York, right? Which is one thing he did in order to help people achieve a kind of Hintonian transcendent form of vision, you know, and see beyond our familiar world into something else, a higher form of unity, right? He used this word brotherhood, you know, a form of brotherhood in which if we had this transcendent vision, we could see all people being a part of one thing somehow. So Bragdon had this kind of vision as well. So Bragdon's doing it in a more public way in urban landscapes, and Max Weber's doing it through modern art. And Max Weber is a bit different as well, right? Max Weber is interested, especially in the second half of his career, he's interested in reincorporating Jewish motifs and Jewish themes and Jewish subjects into his painting. And so then he starts incorporating higher dimensional motifs and Jewish motifs and so on in order to get at the absolute, or in order to somehow depict or render the spirit.
So another really interesting figure that you touch on in the book is John W. Donne. And Donne speculated that it might be possible for violent or traumatic events to fragment time itself or to stimulate an individual's capacity to perceive time differently. And this is a really, really interesting idea. How does this tie into the notion of higher dimensions, this fragmentation of time?
Yeah, right. I mean, Donne's story is a fascinating story, right? I love that chapter, and I loved working on him. He's a pretty interesting guy. And then, you know, a number of people take up his ideas as well and develop them into a whole way of thinking about higher dimensions and a whole new way of thinking about what dreams are and so on. So yeah, that chapter's about dreams, and, you know, it begins with Donne's story. You know, and his story is simply that he, you know, he's in combat in the Second Boer War, and in 1902, he's in a combat setting, he's sleeping at night, and he begins to have a series of really vivid dreams, and really vivid nightmares. And some of them seem to predict the future. So he has these dreams, and, the way it usually worked for Dunn was he would have a dream, and then the next day or the day after that, he would open a newspaper and he would see the dream played out in a headline. So for instance, he had a dream that a train crashed in Scotland and killed a bunch of people, derailed and crashed. And then a few days later, he opened the newspaper and there it was, this train crashes in Scotland. So, and this is kind of how his dreams would work. You know, often dreams of traumatic things, and then he would open a newspaper and see it happen. And sometimes the details were correct, and sometimes some of the details were off a little bit. The story I tell in the chapter that I focus on in the chapter is that he has this dream. And again, this is either during or after his sort of combat experiences. He has this dream where he's on an island and there's a lot of rumbling and there's fissures developing in the ground that are venting steam and gas. And he knows in his dream that something is really wrong. He's on an island. He's surrounded by French speaking people. He's begging people around him to get off the island. And he's running to find police or other authorities and tell them what's going to happen. And then his dream ends. And then a few days later, he opens up the newspaper, and in Martinique, in 1902, there was a volcanic explosion that completely wipes out a whole town and kills 40,000 people. So it's a really dramatic event. And so then he sees it in a newspaper. So he has these experiences. He doesn't really know what's happening. And this is the beginning, according to him, of him thinking about time in new ways. And he was also he describes himself as an amateur mathematician. So he's up on, he's up on mathematics. He's up on developments in science. His job actually is as an aeronautical engineer. He designs early airplanes for the UK. If you Google him, you can see all of his airplane designs. It's pretty cool, actually. J.W. Dunn, D-U-N-N-E, Dunn. You can check out all of his biplanes and so on online. So he has a job as an engineer, but meanwhile, he's sort of puzzling through why this is happening to him. And as you say, or as you mentioned, he has this idea that maybe consciousness somehow becomes fragmented as a result of traumatic experiences. That's one possibility he entertains. He thinks for a while, maybe I've lost it. Maybe I'm going crazy somehow, because of these experiences, and he starts to think about and use higher dimensions and also Einstein's ideas, because, this is after, he starts thinking about this and publishes his big book on this in 1927. And it was in 1919 that, some of Einstein's theories, his theory of gravity, gets proven correct. During observations made during a total solar eclipse in 1919, Einstein becomes very famous worldwide in 1919 as a result of that observation. And there becomes a big pop culture of Einstein after that time. So he's reading popularizations of Einstein and Einstein's sort of strange ideas, right, about there being different and relative frames of reference in the world. So, Einstein's ideas were kind of crazy, because before Einstein, everyone thought, well, space is sort of one sort of uniform spread out thing in the universe, right? It's just kind of one uniform thing. And time is also sort of one spread out kind of uniform thing in the universe. And that's what time is. Well, Einstein comes along and says, no, actually, the only absolute is the speed of light, which never changes. But space and time actually, strangely, are connected in a fabric that he called space-time. And it bends and it stretches. It's really weird, right? And you can have time. Time can change. Time can slow down and speed up depending on your relative frame of reference, depending on how close you might be to a massive object or how fast you might be going relative to something else. So there are all of these different frames of references. So Dunn kind of picks this up and he says, that maybe there are different ways of thinking about time, and maybe there are different reference points for time. And the other thing that Dunn picks up about this is that, in the equations of physics, space-time exists as one sort of cosmic bulk. All right, so this is also weird and hard to imagine, but everything in the universe exists in one big loaf or one big bulk. Everything in your future, Miranda, everything in your past, everything in my future, my past, it all exists in this big block universe. All right. So to us, it feels like we're moving forward through time and experiencing new things, but there's nothing in the equations of physics that says that that's right. Right. In fact, the equations of physics picture or model for us this block universe. And so Dunn ran with that a little bit. He said, well, you know, wait a minute. If it's true that everything exists in this time-space block universe, that means that my future is there somewhere. And then the question for Dunn becomes, how might I travel to it? Right. And maybe in the dreaming consciousness, maybe the dreaming consciousness, Dunn argues, maybe the dreaming consciousness has an extra degree of freedom. And this is where, you know, the dimensions idea comes in a little bit. Maybe the dreaming consciousness has an extra degree of freedom that it can travel in another dimension and rise up somehow above the bulk or above my timeline and peek into a future timeline. So, you know, we could even think about this if we want to go back to Flatland for a second, right? We could think about the ways that the square was peeled off the surface of his two-dimensional flat world and into a higher world. And then what was he able to do? Well, he was able to look down at his flat world and suddenly see the whole thing. In the same way, Dunn thought maybe the dreaming consciousness or the dreaming self can be peeled off of our familiar world momentarily in the dreaming state, and it can peek into the whole thing, or it could somehow glimpse into the whole thing or see something that exists in our future. So that's how Dunn sort of used this idea. Dunn has a number of other fascinating dimensions to his own life, right? That I get to towards the end of that chapter, because he sort of plays the role of this very hard-headed, you know, engineer, this rationalist scientist, which for various reasons that I've already discussed, you sort of have to do, right? You sort of have to do that to pass muster in the scientific community. And he does that. Meanwhile, he's journaling and talking to other people about the kind of mystical experiences he's had all of his life, right? And so, you know, at the end of his life, he publishes a book, or his wife publishes a book actually after he dies, that's all about his more mystical intuitions, right? And the ways that they also were a part of his theories, and a part of his theories about dreaming and his theories about dimensions and time. So he's also sort of, you know, he's not really just this kind of, what would we say, secular scientist trying to find a way to explain his dreams. He also is a kind of a person who's having he's having mystical dreams and intuitions. He's actually hearing voices, right? He's hearing God speaking to him at stressful times in his life and these kinds of things. So he actually has a pretty fascinating biography when you see the whole thing laid out.
So moving into the realm of literature, or starting to maybe focus a bit more specifically on literature, how do these ideas about mathematics, other dimensions, and geometry impact the work of seemingly fantastic writers like George MacDonald, C.S. Lewis, and Lewis Carroll?
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think we tend to associate them perhaps with fairy tales, with the fantastic. Yeah. But yeah. As you posit in your book, these ideas about mathematics and geometry are really very influential on their work.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, I think it's I think that we live in a world in which the most authoritative discourse that we have is a scientific discourse. I mean, I think that I'm not sure if that's controversial to say that or not, but I think that that's kind of the world we live in. I mean, I think when people want to know something, they turn to science. And I think science is wonderful and important in all those ways. And I think that the thinkers you just mentioned, George MacDonald, C.S. Lewis, and even others like Madeleine L'Engle that I talk about in the book, I think that they also thought that. You know, I mean, I think that these are people with metaphysical questions and spiritual questions and religious questions who lived like we do in an age of science. And I think that what they're doing is they're borrowing from science, you know, in order to help them answer some of these deep questions that they have. And I think C.S. Lewis certainly, you know, just to maybe turn to one of the authors that you raised. I mean, I think C.S. Lewis thought like that too, in the sense that he is developing fantastic other worlds, but he wants them to be plausible other worlds, you know, and he wants them to be, you know, and how do you create plausible other worlds? Well, one way might be to create them with a sense of, you know, literary realism and to, and so on. But another way is to kind of borrow from science, you know, and borrow scientific concepts. And he does this as he develops his otherworldly portals and openings in the Narnia series, which I talk about in the book. He does this, you know, he even more explicitly refers to higher dimensions and the mathematics of higher dimensions in some of his theological writing. It's hard to see it if you don't know what you're looking for in On Miracles or Mere Christianity or other places or other sermons that he gives. But you can see it if you've read Abbott and if you've read Hinton, you can see it where it comes through. And it comes through quite explicitly in this wonderful and subtle sermon he gives called Transposition. Wait, do I have that right? I think that's right. Transposition. I think that's right. So, and here he refers to higher dimensions quite explicitly as a way of thinking about or imagining higher dimensional spiritual realities, right? And how they might get into a lower dimensional material world. And so that's one place where he talks quite explicitly about the Hinton Abbott sort of tradition. And he even talks about Flatlanders and so on in that sermon. But he does this elsewhere too. He talks about the Trinity. I mentioned earlier the incarnation, right? And a higher dimensional way of understanding how a higher dimensional God might incarnate itself in a lower dimensional form like Jesus. C.S. Lewis talks like that. He also talks like that when he explains what the Trinity is. You know, how could something that is three, how could something that is one at a higher level be something that is three on a lower level? And he uses higher dimensions and these concepts to explain how that might be. So I think that Lewis is using mathematical and scientific ideas in order to lend plausibility to his arguments about what these Christian theological concepts mean. I think that Abbott was doing that as well, that he was using mathematical ideas to point to or to suggest the reality of spiritual things, right? And I think that Lewis is interested in that too. Like, can we use these concepts to suggest, to at least just suggest or open people's minds to the possibility that something might be higher? Hey, you know, if we know that, or if it's plausible that there is a higher dimensional space that we can't perceive, or other kinds of things that we can't perceive, you know, maybe that makes it more plausible to think that there's a spiritual reality that we can't perceive. So there's a way of appropriating scientific ideas in order to build plausibility into new or reworked religious types of ideas. And earlier we were talking about Max Weber. I think Max Weber does that as he refigures Judaism in his painting, you know, using higher dimensional ideas to refigure tradition, right, and make it more plausible or meaningful for modern people. And Lewis was doing that, and Langell was doing that, and so on. And I use this word enchantment in the book as well for some of these same ideas. Like, is there a way in which fantastic scientific concepts like higher dimensions, or even like, you know, or like the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, or like the many multiverse theories, right? Or dark matter or dark energy or so on. Is there a way in which these fantastic ideas are re-enchanting people's imaginations in modernity. So sometimes I point to Madeleine L'Engle as an example of this, and you asked about L'Engle as well as a literary example of the appropriation of these kind of tropes. L'Engle fits the model perfectly, right? Which is why I write about her. One reason I write about her, she was raised Episcopalian in New York, but she sort of falls away and becomes an atheist. But then she has a whole narrative, you know, an autobiographical narrative where she talks about, well, the reason I came back to sort of mystery and wonder and spirit and God was by reading popular science about, she says, higher math. She means, you know, pop science books about higher dimensions, and also sort of pop science books about Einstein's theories and his mathematics. So she read all of that, and you know, she calls Einstein Saint Einstein. And so she talks about all of these scientific thinkers as the new theologians. So this is really quite explicitly a case of sort of a modern person who finds herself unable to really believe in all these old stories in the Bible, but who gets re-enchanted or develops a new re-enchanted imagination by reading popular science and sort of encountering fantastic science, right? Or fantastic scientific notions. And then, of course, she figures all of this out by writing A Wrinkle in Time, all right, which has this wonderful cultural life to it, even today, and incorporates the Tesseract, right? It takes us back to our earlier conversation about Hinton's Tesseract. She refigures what the Tesseract is in A Wrinkle in Time, actually. But she still has this idea in there that, you know, that the Tesseract gives you access to higher dimensional space. You know, in her fantasy and sci-fi, it gives you access to traveling across vast spaces because it folds space. And she has her own sort of idea or her own ways of appropriating tesseracts and higher dimensions and indeed math and science, right? Which many would push back and say, well, she sort of has misappropriated or not quite understood what the science is, but whatever, you know, I mean, you know, for me, I mean, in my book, I'm interested in not really deciding whether or not people's appropriations of scientific concepts are misappropriations. I'm interested in the cultural power and the imaginative power of these ideas, right, in culture and in pop culture. And they do have a real power, right, to re-enchant and to change. And L'Engle's, like I said, is a perfect example of that. And then in Wrinkle in Time, right, then in turn, this becomes such a powerful part of our culture today for reimagining spirit, for reimagining God, right? And if you know the book Wrinkle in Time, it really is, and it was quite radical for, you know, the early 1960s, but it really does reimagine God. It really does reimagine spirit, incorporate science in these ways, and it reimagines gender, of course, in ways as well. And I talk about that quite a bit in the book about how she's trying to, in many ways, kind of undo the fantastic but patriarchal sort of other worlds of someone like C.S. Lewis. And she's kind of trying to undo that and create a new sort of fantastic other world that is that's an other world that allows women to have a full humanity, which she believed others didn't do.
I think L'Engle actually really brings us up to the middle decades of the 20th century. So thinking a little bit about that time period, in what way did the rise of television and broadcast media transform how people thought about things like higher dimensions?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's something I'm thinking more about now with new projects and my new thinking about, you know, my next book project. And how is it that electronic technologies make possible new sensorial and imaginative possibilities for people? How is it that electronic technologies can produce otherworldly presences, right? Like electronic technologies, radio, television, computers, iPhones, the internet, right? So I'm actually really interested in that. And I think these electronic technologies do actually change how we think. I think they do change how we imagine what religion is, and I think they do change how we think about what the supernatural is, which is a category we haven't talked too much today about, but is a category that's important in my book. You know, how do these electronic technologies make it more possible to imagine the supernatural? So I think those are open questions. In my book, as you say, in chapter 9, towards the end, I do start to talk about that. I talk about television. I talk about early science fiction television that incorporates higher dimensions, like shows like The Outer Limits and Twilight Zone film, and then in films like Interstellar. So I have a whole chapter there where I talk about, excuse me, like the electronic ways of tuning in other dimensions, all right, or electronic ways of tuning in other worlds. And how is that depicted in science fiction? And then how is it practiced in new forms of electronic or electromagnetic spirituality? So in the book, I talk about how televisions are figured in the Twilight Zone, let's say, as these objects of mystical awe and sort of reverence, you know, which is true. When they enter living rooms in the 1950s, really quite dramatically, you know, 1950, very few people had a television. In 1960, 90% of American households have a television. So it really does, you know, quite dramatically enter upon the scene. And it changes how people think about things. So I look at the cultural impact of the TV. I look at these sci-fi shows like The Twilight Zone that actually depict televisions as openings to otherworldly realities. All right, so I look at that in Twilight Zone and Outer Limits. And then in the second half of the chapter, I look at televangelists like Oral Roberts, who famously sort of puts his hand up towards the camera that's filming him as he's preaching, right? And he asks viewers around the world to lay their hands on their television screen. So this raises all kinds of questions about the electronic mediation of the Holy Spirit, you know, or we could say earlier, I used the earlier language of like the technological production of an otherworldly presence, all right? Is this technology producing a kind of, or transmitting? I'm not sure which word to use there, but maybe both, producing or transmitting this otherworldly presence. We could put it differently and say, is this electronic technology making it more possible for people to experience the thoughts or emotions of belief? That's a slightly different way of putting it, I think. But either way, I think all those things are going on when a religious believer is laying her hands on a television screen, right? And feeling healed, or putting their hands in an earlier era on sort of a humming, buzzing, warm radio. Another thing I talk about later in the chapter is, you know, scrying, which is sort of meditating on a screen. So, there are different groups of folks who will meditate on a staticky television screen in order to catch glimpses of the spirits of departed loved ones. So they believe that somehow through meditating on radio static or on television static, that these things are electromagnetic openings to otherworldly spaces or spiritual spaces or heaven. So I talk about them in that chapter as well, which is again about the televisual mediation of otherworldly spirits. So now people do this kind of scrying with their iPhones, with their computer screens and so on. You can Google it and check it out online. There's all kinds of meditative protocols to do this. Again, sort of thinking through the electromagnetic transmission of other worlds through these kinds of devices.
So I think that having moved from 19th century tracts on geometry and mathematics and the fourth dimension right up to television and later on iPhones and contemporary technology, yeah, I think we've really spanned a massive, massive length of time. So
yes, and I've gone on too long too. We're over time.
You know, not even remotely. It was absolutely fascinating. And I think in spanning such a great length of time, I think we've really traced the history of a thoroughly fascinating idea. So it's been really wonderful talking to you about your book and really, really edifying. I feel at this point we've probably taken up enough of your time, but I would like to ask before I let you go, are you working on anything at the moment?
Yeah. I'm working on a couple different things. I mean, I'm editing a book that looks at the sort of religious and spiritual landscape of contemporary America. So that brings together journalists and sociologists and historians and thinking about a movement that's really important actually in Europe and America, which is people who talk about themselves as spiritual, but not religious. There's many sort of quote spiritual or spiritual but not religious people in my book Other Worlds as well, right? I mean, so that these are overlapping projects. So I'm finishing up that edited book, and then I'm wanting to write a new book, and I've already made some headway on it because I actually had a number of chapters in Other Worlds that I threw out that I didn't get a chance to include. And in fact, I had stuff in there I had more stuff on televisions. I had more stuff in there on electronic devices. I had stuff in there on early cinema and surrealism. So I'm actually interested in following through with that and doing more on some of the subjects I was just talking about, which is, you know, how do we think about the ways in which new electronic technologies make possible new imaginative possibilities for people. You know, do these electronic technologies make it possible to be spiritual in new ways? Do they make it seem more plausible? Or do they make belief in such things as like an afterlife or ghosts seem more plausible? And there's a lot of ways that you can talk about that, right? You can talk about all of the, you know, the incredible sort of supernatural programming that you have on television or film, right? There's so many shows about, channeling ghosts or tapping into ghosts or ghost hunting, or, you know, whether it's documentaries or reality shows or films and so on. There's a lot of shows with supernatural content. So I'm interested in that stuff. And then I'm also interested in the kinds of stuff that I just mentioned, which is, you know, how do things like, you know, radio, cinema, television, iPhones, how do they organize new sensorial and imaginative possibilities for people as they think about what it means to believe in a ghost or believe in a spirit, you know, and how do they challenge maybe traditional religion to not really to fold up its tent, but to kind of rethink what religion is and how religion gets technologically mediated. I mean, you certainly see a lot of that. You certainly see a lot of, there's thousands of religious apps, right? Or spiritual apps or meditation apps or so on. I'm interested in all of that, right? The ways that that's going to, the electronic mediation of even traditional religion is going to change things, whether it's Judaism or Christianity or Islam. So I've put in some, like I said, I have some work done on some of that stuff, but I still have to do a lot to pull together a book on it. But those are the kinds of things I want to be working on.
That sounds really wonderful, and I can't wait to read it once you do put it together and once it's published. I suppose just in closing, I wanted to thank you again for appearing on the show. It was a really, really interesting conversation. I feel like I learned an awful lot. I think our listeners learned an awful lot. And I think if they would like to learn more, your book is Other Worlds, Spirituality and the Search for Invisible Dimensions. And it was published earlier this year, and I think it's available through Harvard University Press.
Amazon.
Amazon as well. So wherever good books are sold. But I would definitely recommend anyone who is at all interested in this relationship between the religious and the scientific to check it out, because it is a really, really comprehensive and engaging survey of the development of these kinds of thoughts about higher dimensions. So I'm just going to leave it there.
Let me thank you too. Thanks so much for your great questions and for your interest in my book. It was a pleasure to be on the podcast.
You're most welcome. It was a really, really engaging conversation. So for New Books in Literary Studies, I'm Miranda Corcoran, and thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in.